This is Audible.
Original material, copyrighted 2009, Daniel Coyle. Recorded by arrangement with the Bantam Dell Publishing Group, a division of Random House, Inc. Sound recording, copyrighted 2009, Highbridge Company. All rights reserved. For private use only, not for public performance or broadcast. Unauthorized sale, duplication, or distribution of this recording is prohibited by law.
Highbridge Audio presents The Talent Code, unlocking the secret of skill in sports, art, music, math, and just about anything, by Daniel Coyle. For Jen. Introduction. The girl who did a month's worth of practice in 6 minutes. Then David took his staff in his hand, chose 5 smooth stones from the stream, put them in the pouch of his shepherd's bag, and with his sling in his hand, approached Goliath. 1 Samuel chapter 17, verse 40. Every journey begins with questions, and here are 3. How does a penniless Russian tennis club with 1 indoor court create more top 20 women players than the entire United States? How does a humble storefront music school in Dallas, Texas, produce Jessica Simpson, Demi Lovato, and a succession of pop music phenoms? How does a poor, scantily educated British family in a remote village turn out 3 world-class writers? Talent hotbeds are mysterious places, and the most mysterious thing about them is that they bloom without warning. The first baseball players from the tiny island of the Dominican Republic arrived in the major leagues in the 1950s. They now account for 1 in 9 big league players. The first South Korean woman golfer won a Ladies Professional Golf Association LPGA tournament in 1998. Now there are 45 on the LPGA Tour, including 8 of the top 20 money winners. In 1991, there was only 1 Chinese entry in the Van Cliburn Piano Competition. The most recent competition featured 8, a proportional leap reflected in top symphony orchestras around the world. Media coverage tends to treat each hotbed as a singular phenomenon, but in truth, they're all part of a larger, older pattern. Consider the composers of 19th century Vienna and the writers of Shakespearean England, or the artists of the Italian Renaissance, during which the sleepy city of Florence, population 70,000, suddenly produced an explosion of genius that has never been seen before or since. In each case, the identical questions echo. Where does this extraordinary talent come from? How does it grow? The answer could begin with a remarkable piece of video showing a freckle-faced 13-year-old girl named Clarissa. Clarissa, not her real name, was part of a study by Australian music psychologists Gary McPherson and James Renwick that tracked her progress at the clarinet for several years. Officially, the video's title is ShorterClarissa3.mov, but it should have been called The Girl Who Did a Month's Worth of Practice in 6 Minutes. On screen, Clarissa does not look particularly talented. She wears a blue hooded sweatshirt, gym shorts, and an expression of sleepy indifference. In fact, until the 6 minutes captured on the video, Clarissa had been classified as a musical mediocrity. According to McPherson's aptitude tests and the testimony of her teacher, her parents, and herself, Clarissa possessed no musical gifts. She lacked a good ear, her sense of rhythm was average, her motivation subpar. In the study's written section, she marked, "Because I'm supposed to," as her strongest reason for practicing. Nonetheless, Clarissa had become famous in music science circles, because on an average morning, McPherson's camera captured this average kid doing something distinctly unaverage. In 5 minutes and 54 seconds, she accelerated her learning speed by 10 times, according to McPherson's calculations. What was more, she didn't even notice. McPherson sets up the clip for us. It's morning, Clarissa's customary time for practice, a day after her weekly lesson. She's working on a new song entitled Golden Wedding, a 1941 tune by jazz clarinetist Woody Herman. She's listened to the song a few times. She likes it. Now she's going to try to play it. Clarissa draws a breath and plays 2 notes. Then she stops. She pulls the clarinet from her lips and stares at the paper. Her eyes narrow. She plays 7 notes, the song's opening phrase. She misses the last note and immediately stops, fairly jerking the clarinet from her lips. She squints again at the music and sings the phrase softly. "Da-da-dum-da," she says. She starts over and plays the riff from the beginning, making it a few notes farther into the song this time, missing the last note, backtracking, patching in the fix. The opening is beginning to snap together. The notes have verve and feeling. When she's finished with this phrase, she stops again for 6 long seconds, seeming to replay it in her mind, fingering the clarinet as she thinks. She leans forward, takes a breath, and starts again. It sounds pretty bad. It's not music. It's a broken-up, fitful, slow-motion batch of notes riddled with stops and misses. Common sense would lead us to believe that Clarissa is failing. But in this case, common sense would be dead wrong. "This is amazing stuff," McPherson says. "Every time I watch this, I see new things, incredibly subtle, powerful things. This is how a professional musician would practice on Wednesday for a Saturday performance." On screen, Clarissa leans into the sheet music, puzzling out a G sharp that she's never played before. She looks at her hand, then at the music, then at her hand again. She hums the riff. Clarissa's posture is tilted forward. She looks as though she's walking into a chilly wind. Her sweetly freckled face tightens into a squint. She plays the phrase again and again. Each time, she adds a layer of spirit, rhythm, swing. "Look at that," McPherson says. She's got a blueprint in her mind she's constantly comparing herself to. She's working in phrases, complete thoughts. She's not ignoring errors. She's hearing them, fixing them. She's fitting small parts into the whole, drawing the lens in and out all the time, scaffolding herself to a higher level. This is not ordinary practice. This is something else. A highly targeted, error-focused process. Something is growing, being built. The song begins to emerge, and with it, a new quality within Clarissa. The video rolls on. After practicing Golden Wedding, Clarissa goes on to work on her next piece, The Blue Danube. But this time, she plays it in one go without stopping. Absent of jarring stops, the tune tumbles out in tuneful, recognizable form, albeit with the occasional squeak. McPherson groans. "She just plays it, like she's on a moving sidewalk," he says. "It's completely awful. She's not thinking, not learning, not building, just wasting time. She goes from worse than normal to brilliant and then back again, and she has no idea she's doing it." After a few moments, McPherson can't take it anymore. He rewinds to watch Clarissa practice Golden Wedding again. He wants to watch it for the same reason I do. This is not a picture of talent created by genes. It's something far more interesting. It is 6 minutes of an average person entering a magically productive zone, one where more skill is created with each passing second. "Good God," McPherson says wistfully. "If somebody could bottle this, it'd be worth millions." This book is about a simple idea. Clarissa and the talent hotbeds are doing the same thing. They have tapped into a neurological mechanism in which certain patterns of targeted practice build skill. Without realizing it, they have entered a zone of accelerated learning that, while it can't quite be bottled, can be accessed by those who know how. In short, they've cracked the talent code. The Talent Code is built on revolutionary scientific discoveries involving a neural insulator called myelin, which some neurologists now consider to be the holy grail of acquiring skill. Here's why. Every human skill, whether it's playing baseball or playing Bach, is created by chains of nerve fibers carrying a tiny electrical impulse, basically a signal traveling through a circuit. Myelin's vital role is to wrap those nerve fibers the same way that rubber insulation wraps a copper wire, making the signal stronger and faster by preventing the electrical impulses from leaking out. When we fire our circuits in the right way, when we practice swinging that bat or playing that note, our myelin responds by wrapping layers of insulation around that neural circuit, each new layer adding a bit more skill and speed. The thicker the myelin gets, the better it insulates, and the faster and more accurate our movements and thoughts become. Myelin is important for several reasons. It's universal. Everyone can grow it, most swiftly during childhood, but also throughout life. It's indiscriminate. Its growth enables all manner of skills, mental and physical. It's imperceptible. We can't see it or feel it. And we can sense its increase only by its magical-seeming effects. Most of all, however, myelin is important because it provides us with a vivid new model for understanding skill. Skill is a cellular insulation that wraps neural circuits and that grows in response to certain signals. The more time and energy you put into the right kind of practice, the longer you stay in the Clarissa zone, firing the right signals through your circuits, the more skill you get, or, to put it a slightly different way, the more myelin you earn. All skill acquisitions, and therefore all talent hotbeds, operate on the same principles of action, no matter how different they may appear to us. As Dr. George Bartzokas, a UCLA neurologist and myelin researcher, put it, "All skills, all language, all music, all movements are made of living circuits, and all circuits grow according to certain rules." In the coming pages, we'll see those rules in action by visiting the world's best soccer players, bank robbers, violinists, fighter pilots, artists, and skateboarders. We'll explore some surprising talent hotbeds that are succeeding for reasons that even their inhabitants cannot guess. We'll meet an assortment of scientists, coaches, teachers, and talent researchers who are discovering new tools for acquiring skill. Above all, we'll explore specific ways in which these tools can make a difference in maximizing the potential in our own lives and the lives of those around us. The idea that all skills grow by the same cellular mechanism seems strange and surprising because the skills are so dazzlingly varied. But then again, all of this planet's variety is built from shared adaptive mechanisms. Evolution could have it no other way. Redwoods differ from roses, but both grow through photosynthesis. Elephants differ from amoebas, but both use the same cellular mechanism to convert food into energy. Tennis players, singers, and painters don't seem to have much in common, but they all get better by gradually improving timing and speed and accuracy, by honing neural circuitry, by obeying the rules of the talent code. In short, by growing more myelin. This book is divided into three parts: deep practice, ignition, and master coaching, which correspond to the three basic elements of the talent code. Each element is useful on its own, but their convergence is the key to creating skill. Remove one, and the process slows. Combine them, even for 6 minutes, and things begin to change.
Part 1. Deep Practice. Chapter 1. The Sweet Spot. You will become clever through your mistakes. German proverb. Chicken wire Harvards. In December 2006, I began visiting tiny places that produce Everest-size amounts of talent. My journey began at a ramshackle tennis court in Moscow, and over the next 14 months, it took me to a soccer field in Sao Paulo, Brazil, a vocal studio in Dallas, Texas, an inner-city school in San Jose, California, a rundown music academy in New York's Adirondacks, a baseball-mad island in the Caribbean, and a handful of other places so small, humble, and titanically accomplished that a friend dubbed them the Chicken Wire Harvards. Undertaking the journey presented me with a few challenges, the first of which was to explain it to my wife and four young kids in as logical, read, unharebrained a way as possible. So I decided to frame it as a great expedition, sort of like those undertaken by 19th century naturalists. I made straight-faced comparisons between my trip and Charles Darwin's voyage aboard the Beagle. I sagely expounded how small, isolated places magnify larger patterns and forces, sort of like petri dishes. These explanations seemed to work, at least for a moment. "Daddy's going on a treasure hunt," I overheard my 10-year-old daughter Katie patiently explain to her younger sisters. "You know, like at a birthday party." A treasure hunt. A birthday. Actually, that wasn't too far off. The 9 hotbeds I visited shared almost nothing except the happy unlikeliness of their existence. Each was a statistical impossibility. A mouse that had not only roared, but that had somehow come to rule the forest. But how? The first clue arrived in the form of an unexpected pattern. When I started visiting talent hotbeds, I expected to be dazzled. I expected to witness world-class speed, power, and grace. Those expectations were met and exceeded about half the time. For that half of the time, being in a talent hotbed felt like standing amid a herd of running deer. Everything moved faster and more fluently than in everyday life. You haven't had your ego truly tested until an 8-year-old takes pity on you on the tennis court. But that was only half the time. During the other half, I witnessed something very different. Moments of slow, fitful struggle, rather like what I'd seen on the Clarissa video. It was as if the herd of deer suddenly encountered a hillside coated with ice. They slammed to a halt. They stopped, looked, and thought carefully before taking each step. Making progress became a matter of small failures, a rhythmic pattern of botches, as well as something else, a shared facial expression. Their taut, intense squint caused them to take on, I know this sounds weird, an unaccountable resemblance to Clint Eastwood. Meet Brunio. He's 11 years old, working on a new soccer move on a concrete playground in Sao Paulo, Brazil. He moves slowly, feeling the ball roll beneath the sole of his cheap sneaker. He's trying to learn the elástico, a ball-handling maneuver in which he nudges the ball with the outside of his foot, then quickly swings his foot around the ball to flick it in the opposite direction with his instep. Done properly, the move gives the viewer the impression that the player has the ball on a rubber band. The first time we watch Brunio try the move, he fails, then stops and thinks. He does it again more slowly, and fails again. The ball squirts away. He stops and thinks again. He does it even more slowly, breaking the move down to its component parts. This, this, and that. His face is taut. His eyes are so focused, they look like they're somewhere else. Then something clicks. He starts nailing the move. Meet Jenny. She's 24 years old, and she's in a cramped Dallas vocal studio working on the chorus of a pop song called Running Out of Time. She's trying to hit the big finish, in which she turns the word time into a waterfall of notes. She tries it, screws up, stops and thinks, then sings it again at much slower speed. Each time she misses a note, she stops and returns to the beginning, or to the spot where she missed. Jenny sings and stops, sings and stops. Then all of a sudden she gets it. The pieces snap into place. The sixth time through, Jenny sings the measure perfectly. When we see people practice effectively, we usually describe it with words like willpower or concentration or focus. But those words don't quite fit because they don't capture the ice-climbing particularity of the event. The people inside the talent hotbeds are engaged in an activity that seems on the face of it strange and surprising. They are seeking out the slippery hills. Like Clarissa, they are purposely operating at the edges of their ability, so they will screw up. And somehow, screwing up is making them better. How? Trying to describe the collective talent of Brazilian soccer players is like trying to describe the law of gravity. You can measure it. The 5 World Cup victories, the 900 or so young talents signed each year by professional European clubs. Or you can name it, the procession of transcendent players like Pelé, Zico, Socrates, Romario, Ronaldo, Juninho, Robinho, Ronaldinho, Kaká, and others, who have deservedly worn the crown of world's best player. But in the end, you can't capture the power of Brazilian talent in numbers and names. It has to be felt. Every day, soccer fans around the world witness the quintessential scene. A group of enemy players surround a Brazilian, leaving him no options, no space, no hope. Then there's a dance-like blur of motion, a feint, a flick, a burst of speed, and suddenly the Brazilian player is in the clear, moving away from his now tangled opponents with a casual aplomb of a person stepping off a crowded bus. Each day, Brazil accomplishes something extremely difficult and unlikely. In a game at which the entire world is feverishly competing, it continues to produce an unusually high percentage of the most skilled players. The conventional way to explain this kind of concentrated talent is to attribute it to a combination of genes and environment, aka nature and nurture. In this way of thinking, Brazil is great because it possesses a unique confluence of factors.
a friendly climate, a deep passion for soccer, and a genetically diverse population of 190 million, 40% of whom are desperately poor and long to escape through the beautiful game. Add up all the factors and voila, you have the ideal factory for soccer greatness. But there's a slight problem with this explanation. Brazil wasn't always a great producer of soccer players. In the 1940s and 50s, with its trifecta of climate, passion, and poverty already firmly in place, the ideal factory produced unspectacular results, never winning a World Cup, failing to defeat then-world power Hungary in four tries, showing few of the dazzling improvisational skills for which it would later become known. It wasn't until 1958 that the Brazil the world now recognizes truly arrived in the form of a brilliant team featuring 17-year-old Pelé at the World Cup in Sweden. If sometime during the next decade Brazil should shockingly lose its lofty place in the sport, as Hungary so shockingly did, then the Brazil is unique argument leaves us with no conceivable response except to shrug and celebrate the new champion, which undoubtedly will also possess a set of characteristics all its own. So, how does Brazil produce so many great players? The surprising answer is that Brazil produces great players because since the 1950s, Brazilian players have trained in a particular way, with a particular tool that improves ball handling skill faster than anywhere else in the world. Like a nation of Clarissas, they have found a way to increase their learning velocity, and like her, they are barely aware of it. I call this kind of training deep practice. And as we'll see, it applies to more than soccer. The best way to understand the concept of deep practice is to do it. For example, let's say you're at a party and you're struggling to remember someone's name. If someone gives you that name, the odds of your forgetting it again are high. But if you manage to retrieve that name on your own, to fire the signal yourself, as opposed to passively receiving the information, you'll engrave it into your memory, not because that name is somehow more important or because your memory improved, but simply because you practiced deeper. Or let's say you're on an airplane, and for the umpteenth time in your life you watch the cabin steward give that clear, concise, one-minute demonstration of how to put on a life vest. Slip the vest over your head, the instructions say, and fasten the two black straps to the front of the vest. Inflate the vest by pulling down on the red tabs. An hour into the flight, the plane lurches and the captain's urgent voice comes on the intercom telling passengers to put on their life vests. How quickly could you do it? How do those black straps wrap around? What do the red tabs do again? Here's an alternate scenario. Same airplane flight, but this time instead of observing yet another life jacket demonstration, you try on the life vest. You pull the yellow plastic over your head, and you fiddle with the tabs and the straps. An hour later, the plane lurches, and the captain's voice comes over the intercom. How much faster would you be? Deep practice is built on a paradox. Struggling in certain targeted ways, operating at the edges of your ability, where you make mistakes, makes you smarter. Or, to put it a slightly different way, experiences where you're forced to slow down, make errors, and correct them, as you would if you were walking up an ice-covered hill, slipping and stumbling as you go, end up making you swift and graceful without you realizing it. We think of effortless performance as desirable, but it's really a terrible way to learn, says Robert Bjork, the man who developed the above examples. Bjork, the chair of psychology at UCLA, has spent most of his life delving into questions of memory and learning. He's a cheerful polymath, equally adept at discussing curves of memory decay or how NBA star Shaquille O'Neal, who is notoriously terrible at shooting free throws, should practice them from odd distances, 14 feet and 16 feet instead of the standard 15 feet. Bjork's diagnosis, Shaq needs to develop the ability to modulate his motor programs. Until then, he'll keep being awful. Things that appear to be obstacles turn out to be desirable in the long haul, Bjork said. One real encounter, even for a few seconds, is far more useful than several hundred observations. Bjork cites an experiment by psychologist Henry Rediger at Washington University of St. Louis, where students were divided into two groups to study a natural history text. Group A studied the paper for four sessions. Group B studied only once, but was tested three times. A week later, both groups were tested again, and Group B scored 50% higher than Group A. They had studied one-fourth as much, yet learned far more. Catherine Fritz, one of Bjork's students, said she applied these ideas to her schoolwork and raised her GPA by a full point while studying half as much. The reason, Bjork explained, resides in the way our brains are built. We tend to think of our memory as a tape recorder, but that's wrong, he said. It's a living structure, a scaffold of nearly infinite size. The more we generate impulses, encountering and overcoming difficulties, the more scaffolding we build. The more scaffolding we build, the faster we learn. When you're practicing deeply, the world's usual rules are suspended. You use time more efficiently. Your small efforts produce big, lasting results. You have positioned yourself at a place of leverage where you can capture failure and turn it into skill. The trick is to choose a goal just beyond your present abilities, to target the struggle. Thrashing blindly doesn't help. Reaching does. It's all about finding the sweet spot, Bjork said. There's an optimal gap between what you know and what you're trying to do. When you find that sweet spot, learning takes off. Deep practice is a strange concept for two reasons. The first reason is that it cuts against our intuition about talent. Our intuition tells us that practice relates to talent in the same way that a whetstone relates to a knife. It's vital, but useless without a solid blade of so-called natural ability. Deep practice raises an intriguing possibility that practice might be the way to forge the blade itself. The second reason deep practice is a strange concept is that it takes events that we normally strive to avoid, namely mistakes, and turns them into skills. To understand how deep practice works, then, it's first useful to consider the unexpected but crucial importance of errors to the learning process. In fact, let's consider an extreme example, which arrives in the form of a question. How do you get good at something when making a mistake has a decent chance of killing you? Edwin Link's unusual device. In the winter of 1934, President Franklin Roosevelt had a problem. Pilots in the U.S. Army Air Corps, by all accounts the military's most skilled combat-ready airmen, were dying in crashes. On February 23rd, a pilot drowned when he landed off the New Jersey coast. Another was killed when his plane cartwheeled into a Texas ditch. On March 9th, four more pilots died when their planes crashed in Florida, Ohio, and Wyoming. The carnage was not caused by a war. The pilots were simply trying to fly through winter storms, delivering the U.S. mail. The crashes could be traced to a corporate scandal. A recent Senate investigation had exposed a multi-million dollar price-fixing scheme among the commercial airlines contracted to carry the U.S. mail. President Roosevelt had swiftly responded by canceling the contracts. To take over mail delivery, the president called upon the Air Corps, whose generals were eager to demonstrate their pilots' willingness and bravery. They also wanted to show Roosevelt that the Air Corps deserved the status of a full military branch equal to the Army and Navy. Those generals were mostly right about Air Corps pilots. They were willing, and they were brave. But in the harsh winter storms of 1934, Air Corps pilots kept crashing. Early on the morning of March 10th, after the ninth pilot died in 20 days, FDR summoned General Benjamin Folloy, commander of the Air Corps, to the White House. "General," the president said fiercely, "when are these airmail killings going to stop?" It was a good question, one that Roosevelt might have directed at the whole enterprise of pilot training. Early pilot training was built on the bedrock belief that good pilots are born, not made. Most programs followed an identical procedure. The instructor would take the prospective student up in the plane and execute a series of loops and rolls. If the student did not get sick, he was deemed to have the capability to become a pilot, and after several weeks of ground school was gradually allowed to handle the controls. Trainees learned by taxiing or penguin hopping in stubby winged crafts, or they flew and hoped. Lucky Lindy's nickname was well earned. The system didn't work too well. Early fatality rates at some Army aviation schools approached 25%. In 1912, 8 of the 14 U.S. Army pilots died in crashes. By 1934, techniques and technology had been refined, but training remained primitive. The airmail fiasco, as Roosevelt's problem swiftly became known, raised the question pointedly.
Was there a better way to learn to fly? The answer came from an unlikely source, Edwin Albert Link, Jr., the son of a piano and organ maker from Binghamton, New York, who grew up working at his father's factory. Skinny, beak-nosed, and epically stubborn, Link was a tinkerer by nature. When he was 16, he fell in love with flying and took a $50 lesson from Sidney Chaplin, half-brother of the movie star. For the better part of that hour, we did loops and spins and buzzed everything in sight, Link later recalled. Thank heaven I didn't get sick. But when we got down, I hadn't touched the controls at all. I thought, that's a hell of a way to teach someone to fly. Link's fascination grew. He started hanging around local barnstormers, catching lessons. Link's father didn't appreciate his interest in flying. He briefly fired young Edwin from his job at the organ factory when he found out about it. But Link kept at it, eventually purchasing a 4-seat Cessna. All the while, his tinkerer's mind kept circling the notion of improving pilot training. In 1927, 7 years after his initial lesson with Chaplin, Link went to work. Borrowing bellows and pneumatic pumps from the organ factory, he built a device that compressed the key elements of a plane into a space slightly roomier than a bathtub. It featured stubby prehensile wings, a tiny tail, an instrument panel, and an electric motor that made the device roll, pitch, and yaw in response to the pilot's controls. A small light on the nose lit up when the pilot made an error. Link christened it the Link Aviation Trainer and put up an advertisement. He would teach regular flying and instrument flying, that is, the ability to fly blind through fog and storms while relying on gauges alone. He would teach pilots to fly in half the time of regular training and at a fraction of the cost. To say that the world overlooked Link's trainer wouldn't be accurate. The truth was, the world looked at it and issued a resounding and conclusive no. No one he approached seemed interested in Link's device. Not the military academies, not private flying schools, not even barnstormers. After all, how could you learn to fly in a child's toy? No less an authority than the U.S. Patent Office declared Link's trainer a novel, profitable amusement device. And so it seemed destined to become. While Link sold 50 trainers to amusement parks and penny arcades, only two reached actual training facilities. One he sold to a Navy airfield in Pensacola, Florida, and another he loaned to the New Jersey National Guard Unit in Newark. By the early 1930s, Link was reduced to hauling one of his trainers in a flatbed truck to county fairgrounds, charging 25 cents a ride. When the airmail fiasco hit in the winter of 1934, however, a group of Air Corps brass grew desperate. Casey Jones, a veteran pilot who had trained many of the Army pilots, recalled Link's trainer and persuaded a group of Air Corps officers to take a second look. In early March, Link was summoned to fly from his home in Cortland, New York, to Newark, to demonstrate the trainer he'd loaned to the National Guard. The appointed day was cloudy, with zero visibility, nasty winds, and driving rain. The Air Corps commanders, by now familiar with the possible outcomes of such hazards, surmised that no pilot, no matter how brave or skilled, could possibly fly in such weather. They were just leaving the field when they heard a telltale drone overhead in the clouds, steadily descending. Link's plane appeared as a ghost, materializing only a few feet above the runway, kissed down with a perfect landing, and taxied up to the surprised generals. The skinny fellow did not look like Lindbergh, but he flew like him, and on instruments no less. Link proceeded to demonstrate his trainer. And in one of the first recorded instances of nerd power trumping military tradition, the officers understood its potential. The generals ordered the first shipment of Link trainers. 7 years later, World War II began, and with it the need to transform thousands of unskilled youth into pilots as quickly and safely as possible. That need was answered by 10,000 Link trainers. By the end of the war, a 500,000 airmen had logged millions of hours in what they fondly called the Blue Box. In 1947, the Air Corps became the U.S. Air Force, and Link went on to build simulators for jets, bombers, and the lunar module for the Apollo mission. Edwin Link's trainer worked so well because it permitted pilots to practice more deeply, to stop, struggle, make errors, and learn from them. During a few hours in a Link trainer, a pilot could take off and land a dozen times on instruments. He could dive, stall, and recover,
spending hours inhabiting the sweet spot at the edge of his capabilities in ways he could never risk in an actual plane. The Air Corps pilots who trained in Lynx were no braver or smarter than the ones who crashed. They simply had the opportunity to practice more deeply. This idea of deep practice makes perfect sense in training for dangerous jobs like those of fighter pilots and astronauts. It gets interesting, however, when we apply it to other kinds of skills, like, for instance, those of Brazil's soccer players. Brazil's secret weapon. Like many sports fans around the world, soccer coach Simon Clifford was fascinated by the supernatural skills of Brazilian soccer players. Unlike most fans, however, he decided to go to Brazil to see if he could find out how they developed those skills. This was an unusually ambitious initiative on Clifford's part, considering that he had gained all his coaching experience at a Catholic elementary school in the soccer non-hotbed of Leeds, England. Then again, Clifford is not what you'd call usual. He's tall and dashingly handsome and radiates the sort of charismatic, bulletproof confidence one usually associates with missionaries and emperors. In his early 20s, Clifford was severely injured in a freak soccer accident, suffering internal organ damage, kidney removal, and perhaps as a result he approaches each day with immoderate zeal. In the summer of 1997, when he was 26, Clifford borrowed $8,000 from his teachers' union and set out for Brazil, toting a backpack, a video camera, and a notebook full of phone numbers he'd cajoled from a Brazilian player he'd met. Once there, Clifford spent most of his time exploring the thronging expanse of Sao Paulo, sleeping in roach-infested dormitories by night, scribbling notes by day. He saw many things he'd expected to find: the passion, the tradition, the highly organized training centers, the long practice sessions. Teenage players at Brazilian soccer academies log 20 hours per week compared with 5 hours per week for their British counterparts. He saw the towering poverty of the favelas and the desperation in the players' eyes. But Clifford also saw something he didn't expect: a strange game. It resembled soccer, if soccer were played inside a phone booth and dosed with amphetamines. The ball was half the size, but weighed twice as much. It hardly bounced at all. The players trained not on a vast expanse of grass field, but on basketball court-sized patches of concrete, wooden floor, and dirt. Each side, instead of having 11 players, had 5 or 6. In its rhythm and blinding speed, the game resembled basketball or hockey more than soccer. It consisted of an intricate series of quick, controlled passes and non-stop end-to-end action. The game was called Futebol de Salão, Portuguese for soccer in the room. Its modern incarnation was called futsal. It was clear to me that this was where Brazilian skills were born, Clifford said. It was like finding the missing link. Futsal had been invented in 1930 as a rainy day training option by a Uruguayan coach. Brazilians quickly seized upon it and codified the first rules in 1936. Since then, the game had spread like a virus, especially in Brazil's crowded cities, and it quickly came to occupy a unique place in Brazilian sporting culture. Other nations played futsal, but Brazil became uniquely obsessed with it, in part because the game could be played anywhere, no small advantage in a nation where grass fields are rare. Futsal grew to command the passions of Brazilian kids in the same way that pickup basketball commands the passions of inner-city American kids. Brazil dominates the sport's organized version, winning 35 of 38 international competitions, according to Vicente Figueiredo, author of History of Futebol de Salão. But that number only suggests the time, effort, and energy that Brazil pours into this strange homemade game. As Alex Bellos, author of Futebol, Soccer the Brazilian Way, wrote, "Futsal is regarded as the incubator of the Brazilian soul." The incubation is reflected in players' biographies. From Pelé onward, virtually every great Brazilian player played futsal as a kid, first in the neighborhood and later at Brazil's soccer academies, where, from ages 7 to around 12, they typically devoted 3 days a week to futsal. A top Brazilian player spends thousands of hours at the game. The great Juninho, for instance, said he never kicked a full-size ball on grass until he was 14. Until he was 12, Robinho spent half his training time playing futsal. like a vintner identifying a lovely strain of grape. A cognoscento, like Dr. Emilio Miranda, professor of soccer at the University of Sao Paulo, can identify the futsal wiring within famous Brazilian soccer tricks. That elástico move that Ronaldinho popularized, drawing the ball in and out like a yo-yo, it originated in futsal. The toe-poke goal that Ronaldo scored in the 2002 World Cup, again, futsal. Moves like the despero, el barré, and vaselina, all came from futsal. When I told Miranda that I'd imagined Brazilians built skills by playing soccer on the beach, he laughed. Journalists fly here, go to the beach, they take pictures and write stories. But great players don't come from the beach. They come from the futsal court. One reason lies in the math. Futsal players touch the ball far more often than soccer players, 6 times more often per minute, according to a Liverpool University study. The smaller, heavier ball demands and rewards more precise handling. As coaches point out, you can't get out of a tight spot simply by booting the ball downfield. Sharp passing is paramount. The game is all about looking for angles and spaces and working quick combinations with other players. Ball control and vision are crucial, so that when futsal players play the full-size game, they feel as if they have acres of free space in which to operate. When I watched professional outdoor games in Sao Paulo sitting with Dr. Miranda, he would point out players who had played futsal. He could tell by the way they held the ball. They didn't care how close their opponent came. As Dr. Miranda summed up, no time plus no space equals better skills. Futsal is our national laboratory of improvisation. In other words, Brazilian soccer is different from the rest of the world's because Brazil employs the sporting equivalent of a link trainer. Futsal compresses soccer's essential skills into a small box. It places players inside the deep practice zone, making and correcting errors, constantly generating solutions to vivid problems. Players touching the ball 600% more often learn far faster without realizing it than they would in the vast, bouncy expanse of the outdoor game, where at least in my mind players run along to the soundtrack of Clarissa tootling away on the Blue Danube. To be clear, futsal is not the only reason Brazilian soccer is great. The other factors so often cited, climate, passion, and poverty, really do matter. But futsal is the lever through which those other factors transfer their force. When Simon Clifford saw futsal, he got excited. He returned home, quit his teaching job, and he founded the International Confederation of Football de Salão in a spare room of his house, developing a soccer program for elementary and high school age kids that he called the Brazilian Soccer School. He constructed an elaborate series of drills based on futsal moves. His players, who mostly hailed from a rough, impoverished area of Leeds, started imitating the Zicos and Ronaldinhos. To create the proper ambiance, Clifford played samba music on a boombox. Let's step back a moment and take an objective look at what Clifford was doing. He was running an experiment to see whether Brazil's million-footed talent factory could be grafted to an utterly foreign land via this small, silly game. He was betting that the act of playing futsal would cause some glowing kernel of Brazilian magic to take root in sooty, chilly Leeds. When the citizens of Leeds heard of Clifford's plan, they were mildly entertained. When they actually witnessed his school in action, they were in grave danger of laughing themselves to death at the spectacle. Dozens of pale, pink-cheeked, thick-necked Yorkshire kids kicking around small, too-heavy balls, learning fancy tricks to the tune of samba music. It was a laugh, except for one detail. Clifford was right. 4 years later, Clifford's team of under-14s defeated the Scottish national team of the same age. It went on to beat the Irish national team as well. One of his Leeds kids, a defender named Micah Richards, now plays for the English national team. Clifford's Brazilian soccer school has expanded to a dozen countries around the world. More stars, Clifford says, are on the way. Chapter 2. The Deep Practice Cell. I have always maintained that excepting fools, men did not differ much in intellect, only in zeal and hard work. Charles Darwin. Installing natural broadband. Deep practice is a powerful idea because it seems magical. Clarissa begins as an average musician and in 6 minutes accomplishes a month's worth of work. A dangerously unskilled pilot climbs into a Link trainer and within a few hours emerges with new abilities. The fact that a targeted effort can increase learning velocity tenfold sounds like a fairy tale in which a handful of tiny seeds grow into an enchanted vine. But strangely, the enchanted vine turns out to be something close to neurological fact. Early in my travels, I was introduced to a microscopic substance called myelin. One of myelin's side effects is to cause sober-minded neurologists to smile and stammer like explorers who've just stepped ashore on a vast and promising new continent. They don't want to behave like this. They do their best to stay serious and appropriately neurologist-like. But myelin won't let them. Knowing about myelin changes the way they see the world. "It's wow! It's big!" said Dr. Douglas Fields, director of the Laboratory of Developmental Neurobiology at the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland. "It's early, but this could be huge. Revolutionary," Dr. George Bartsokas, professor of neurology at UCLA, told me. "Myelin is the key to talking, reading, learning skills, being human." Like most people, I was under the impression that the key to learning skills and being human resided in our brain's neurons, that flickering web of interconnected nerve fibers and the famous synapses through which they link and communicate. But Fields, Bartsokas, and others informed me that while they still consider neurons and synapses to be vitally important, the traditional neuron-centric worldview is being fundamentally altered by a Copernican-sized revolution. This humble-looking insulation, it turns out, plays a key role in the way our brains function, particularly when it comes to acquiring skills. The revolution is built on three simple facts. One, every human movement, thought, or feeling is a precisely timed electric signal traveling through a chain of neurons, a circuit of nerve fibers. Two, myelin is the insulation that wraps these nerve fibers and increases signal strength, speed, and accuracy. Three, the more we fire a particular circuit, the more myelin optimizes that circuit, and the stronger, faster, and more fluent our movements and thoughts become. Everything neurons do, they do pretty quickly. It happens with the flick of a switch, Field said, referring to synapses. But flicking switches is not how we learn a lot of things. Getting good at piano or chess or baseball takes a lot of time, and that's what myelin is good at. What do good athletes do when they train? Bartsokas said. They send precise impulses along wires that give the signal to myelinate that wire. They end up, after all the training, with a super-duper wire. Lots of bandwidth, a high-speed T3 line. That's what makes them different from the rest of us. I asked Fields if myelin might have something to do with the phenomenon of talent hotbeds. He didn't hesitate. I would predict that South Korean women golfers have more myelin on average than players from other countries, he said. They've got more in the right parts of the brain and for the right muscle groups, and that's what allows them to optimize their circuitry. The same would be true for any group like that. Tiger Woods? I asked. Definitely Tiger Woods, Field said. That guy's got a lot of myelin. Researchers like Fields are attracted to myelin because it promises to provide insights into the biological roots of learning and of cognitive disorders. For our purposes, however, the workings of myelin link the various talent hotbeds to each other and to the rest of us. Myelination bears the same relationship to human skill as plate tectonics does to geology, or as natural selection does to evolution. It explains the world's complexity with a simple, elegant mechanism. Skill is myelin insulation that wraps neural circuits and that grows according to certain signals. The story of skill and talent is the story of myelin. Clarissa couldn't feel it, but when she was deep practicing Golden Wedding, she was firing and optimizing a neural circuit and growing myelin. When Air Corps pilots deep practiced inside Edwin Link's trainer, they were firing and optimizing neural circuits and growing myelin. When Ronaldinho and Ronaldo played futsal, they were firing and optimizing their circuits more often and more precisely than when they played the outdoor game. They were growing more myelin. Like any decent epiphany, the recognition of the importance of myelin jolts old perceptions. After I visited Fields and the other myelin scientists, I felt as if I had donned X-ray glasses that showed me a new way of seeing the world. I saw myelin's principles operating not just in the talent hotbeds, but also in my kids' piano practicing, in my wife's new hockey obsession, and in my questionable forays into karaoke. It was an unambiguously good feeling, a happy buzz of replacing guesswork and voodoo with a clear, understandable mechanism. Hazy questions snapped into focus. Question: why is targeted, mistake-focused practice so effective? Answer: because the best way to build a good circuit is to fire it, attend to mistakes, then fire it again over and over. Struggle is not an option. It's a biological requirement. Question: why are passion and persistence key ingredients of talent? Answer: because wrapping myelin around a big circuit requires immense energy and time. If you don't love it, you'll never work hard enough to be great. Question: what's the best way to get to Carnegie Hall? Answer: go straight down Myelin Street. My journey down Myelin Street began with a visit to an incubator at the Laboratory of Developmental Neurobiology at the National Institutes of Health. The incubator, about the size of a small refrigerator, held shiny wire racks, on which sat several rows of petri dishes containing a pink Gatorade-looking liquid. Inside the pink liquid were platinum electrodes, sending tiny bursts of current to mouse neurons covered with a pearlescent white substance. "That's it," said Dr. Fields. "That's the stuff." Fields, 54, is a sinewy, energetic man with a broad smile and a jaunty gait. A former biological oceanographer, he oversees a 6-person, 7-room lab that is outfitted with hissing canisters, buzzing electrical boxes, and tidy bundles of wires and hoses, and that resembles nothing so much as a tidy, efficient ship. In addition, Fields has the sea captain's habit of making extremely exciting moments sound matter-of-fact. The more exciting something is, the more boring he makes it seem. For instance, he was telling me about a 6-day climb of Yosemite's 3,500-foot El Capitan that he made 2 summers back. And I asked what it felt like to sleep while hanging from a rope thousands of feet above the ground. "It's actually not that different," Field said, his expression so unchanging that he might have been discussing a trip to the grocery store. "You adapt." Now Fields reaches into the incubator, extracts one of the pink petri dishes, and slides it beneath a microscope. His voice is quiet. "Have a peek," he says. I lean in, expecting to see something sci-fi and magical-looking. Instead, I see a tangled bunch of spaghetti-like threads, which Fields informs me are nerve fibers. The myelin is harder to see, a faintly undulating fringe on the edge of the neurons. I blink, refocus, and struggle to imagine how this stuff may be the common link between Mozart and Michael Jordan, or at the very least the key to improving my golf game. Fortunately, Dr. Fields is a good teacher, and in our conversations over the previous days, he has explained the 2 principles that underpin an understanding of myelin and skill. Talking to him, as to many neurologists, feels something like mountain climbing itself. It involves a bit of sweat, but you're rewarded with a new and lofty perspective. For starters, there's useful brain science insight number 1. All actions are really the result of electrical impulses sent along chains of nerve fibers. Basically, our brains are bundles of wires, 100 billion wires called neurons connected to each other by synapses. Whenever you do something, your brain sends a signal through those chains of nerve fibers to your muscles. Each time you practice anything, sing a tune, swing a club, read this sentence, a different, highly specific circuit lights up in your mind. Sort of like a string of Christmas lights. The simplest skill, say a tennis backhand, involves a circuit made up of hundreds of thousands of fibers and synapses. The input is all the stuff that happens before we perform an action, seeing the ball, feeling the racket's position in our hand, deciding to swing. The output is the performance itself, the signals that move the muscles with the right timing and force to take a step, turn the hips, the shoulders, the arm. When you hit that backhand, or play an A minor chord, or make a chess move, an impulse travels down those fibers like voltage through a cord, triggering the other fibers to fire. The point is that these circuits, not our obedient, mindless muscles, are the true control center of every human movement, thought, and skill. In a profound way, the circuit is the movement. It dictates the precise strength and timing of each muscle contraction, the shape and content of each thought. A sluggish, unreliable circuit means a sluggish, unreliable movement. On the other hand, a fast, synchronous circuit means a fast, synchronous movement. When a coach uses the phrase muscle memory, he's actually talking about circuits. By themselves, our muscles are as useful as a puppet without strings. As Dr. Fields puts it, our skills are all in our wires. Then there's useful brain science insight number two. The more we develop a skill circuit, the less we're aware that we're using it. We're built to make skills automatic, to stash them in our unconscious mind. This process, which is called automaticity, exists for powerful evolutionary reasons. The more processing we can do in our unconscious minds, the better our chances of noticing that saber-toothed tiger lurking in the brush. It also creates a powerfully convincing illusion. A skill, once gained, feels utterly natural, as if it's something we've always possessed. These two insights, skills as brain circuits and automaticity, create a paradoxical combination. We are forever building vast, intricate circuits, and we're simultaneously forgetting that we built them, which is where myelin comes in. To say that myelin looks boring is to flatter it. Myelin does not look merely boring, it looks fantastically, unrelentingly, stupendously dull. If the brain is a Blade Runner cityscape of dazzling neuronal structures, flashing lights and whizzing impulses, then myelin plays the humble role of the asphalt. It's the uniform, seemingly inert infrastructure. It's composed of a mundanity known as phospholipid membrane, a dense fat that wraps like electrical tape around a nerve fiber, preventing the electrical impulses from leaking out. It arrives in a series of long, rounded shapes that more than one neurologist unpoetically describes as sausagey. Given the seemingly obvious supremacy of neurons, the first brain researchers confidently named their new science neurology, even though myelin and its supporter cells, known as white matter, account for more than half of the brain's mass. For a century, researchers have focused their attention on neurons and synapses rather than on their seemingly inert insulation, which they studied mostly in relation to multiple sclerosis and other myelin-destroying autoimmune diseases. As it turned out, researchers were mostly correct. Neurons and synapses can indeed explain almost every class of mental phenomena, memory, emotion, muscle control, sensory perception, and so on. But there's a key question that neurons can't explain. Why does it take people so long to learn complex skills? One of the first clues to myelin's role was uncovered in the mid-1980s by an experiment involving rats and Tonka toy dump trucks. Bill Greenow at the University of Illinois raised three groups of rats in varying ways. In the first group, individual rats were isolated from other rats, each one in a large plastic shoebox. The rats in the second group were raised with other rats, but also in shoeboxes. The rats in the third group, however, were raised in an enriched environment surrounded by other rats and a pile of toys that they instinctively played with, even to the point of figuring out how to work the lever on the dump truck. When Greenow autopsied the animals' brains after 2 months, he found that the number of synapses in the enriched environment group had increased by 25% compared with the other two groups. Greenow's work was well received, helping establish the idea of brain plasticity. In particular, the notion that the brain has critical developmental windows during which its growth responds to its environment. But buried in Greenow's study was a secondary finding that was largely ignored by the scientific community. Something else had also grown by 25% in the enriched environment group. White matter. Myelin. We'd been ignoring myelin. Everybody thought it was a bystander, Greenow said. but then it became clear that big things were happening there. Still, neurons and synapses continued to get the lion's share of research attention until around 2000, when a powerful new technology called diffusion tensor imaging allowed neurologists to measure and map myelin inside living subjects. Suddenly, researchers began to link structural deficiencies